This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by INE, the market leader in CCIE training. Interested in training with some of the most experienced Cisco certified trainers in the world? Visit INE.com today to get started. Use promo code PACKETPUSHERS to get 30 rack rental tokens with your purchase of $100 or more from now until December 31st. You're listening to the Packet Pushers podcast. This is a data networking podcast, and today's show is part two of The Nightmare Before Christmas. These are stories from network engineers talking about the worst day ever. Network is down, everything is blown up, and now what do we do? And we're continuing with the same crew we had in part one. This is just a continuation of the stories that we told. It was a two-hour conversation, so in part one, you got roughly the first hour, and in part two is the rest of what we chat about. It's a good time, and I hope you are enjoying your holidays, and thanks for spending a little bit of time with the Packet Pushers.
The conversation about, around HA and making things more complicated, actually at the same location where I've actually got my real story for the nightmare. The gentleman that was there, my predecessor, we were in the data center one day and we had these PIX 535 firewalls that were set up as a cluster. And he goes, I'm gonna fail over to the secondary. And I looked at him and I said, well, can you do that in the middle of the day? And he goes, oh yeah, no, it's okay. He goes, the secondary is gonna take over, we'll be fine. And I said, okay, great. I said, if you're sure you can do that. So he goes ahead, tries to fail over to the secondary, and had only configured one of the six interfaces on the secondary. So literally the entire, I mean, just about everything went down, and then he couldn't figure it out. And he's like, okay, well, I got to fail back over to the primary. And I was like, yeah, you should probably do that before someone comes up here.
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us the rest of your story then?
Okay, sure. Yeah, no, so this was... ironically, I actually have the after-action report that I typed up in front of me here, because this one was definitely something that's going to be scorched on my memory for quite some time. So I was at a large agency, and it was funny listening to Daniel tell his story. I was like, if I didn't know any better, I'd say Daniel and I have either worked together or worked for the same people at the same time at some point in our career. So,
I can sympathize with his story, and I'm sitting here thinking, am I allowed to talk about my experiences exactly?
So I had just sat down at my desk, had just taken my lunch out of my cooler, and a good friend of mine, still a good friend of mine to this day, by the name of Alex, came over, and he's from Southern California, so he had his jeans on and had both hands in his pockets, and he goes, "Hey, dude, your VPN's broke." And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean? He goes, I just got kicked off the VPN. He goes, you got to get that thing fixed. And so we had a pair of Cisco VPN 3000 3015 concentrators that we were using. And we had also had some Juniper VPNs in there. And I said, you should try the Junipers. And he goes, no, dude. He goes, I got to go get something to eat. He goes, I'll be back. And I was like, okay, cool. So I cruise up to the data center to try to figure out why the VPN isn't working, tried it from my desk, and to take a quick step back, the area that we sat in was air-gapped from the actual data center for security reasons, so you actually had to VPN in to the data center. So I walk up to the data center, and I check the VPN, and the VPN looks fine. It's up. There don't seem to be any error messages on the VPN, and I'm like, well, this is odd. So as I'm up there checking the VPN, one of the systems team leads comes up and he says, yeah, he goes, hey, we got some problems downstairs. No one can get to the VPN. And I said, yeah, I said, I'm taking a look at it right now. I said, have you tried the Juniper VPNs? I think maybe is it just something wrong with the Cisco VPNs, and give me some time to troubleshoot it. He goes, no, we can't get to any of the VPNs. And I'm like, this can't be good. So then I'm scrambling in my head to try to figure out, okay, well, there were no changes that were to be done today. There was no change board meeting, so nothing should have changed. And I asked him, I said, hey, Ed, did something change? Has anybody done anything on the network that you know of? And he goes, no. He goes, nothing should have changed. I'm like, okay, great. So I start taking a look at the Juniper VPNs, and the Juniper VPNs look great. So right after that, Ed had gone downstairs. He comes back up and he goes, hey, listen, man. He goes, I think we got big problems. I'm like, yeah, what's up? And he goes, well, I'm actually, you know, on the other side of the data center over here, and I'm on one of our web servers. He goes, and I can't get to anything within the same VLAN. And I was like, all right, well, this can't be good. So we narrowed it down to, it was in the, we had different zones at the time, and we narrowed it down to there was something was going on in the production zone. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's get on the core production switch, which at the time was a 6509 that had, you know, 7 line cards, 48 ports each line card, and the supervisors. And we were just, I mean, pretty much at capacity. So I try to console onto the switch, and I can't even get consoled onto the switch. And I'm like, well, God, this is really weird. So at this point, I jump onto the firewalls, and there are literally thousands of messages spewing about flapping Macs and all kinds of issues on the firewall. So I'm like, okay. I said, well, it's clearly something to do with you know, VLAN 2, which is our production zone. And Ed and I were like, okay, well, you know, let's take a further, let's go back and look at the switch again and see what we can see, because something's obviously wrong there. And right as soon as we said that, at that point, the SSO comes in and literally, not at a jog, almost a sprint to our location. And he's like, he goes, listen, I've heard that there's some issues up here. Everybody's down right now. We're not getting any of our data out. He goes, what's the problem? And I said, well, you know, we're troubleshooting that right now. So we've kind of narrowed it down that something's going on in this zone. But we had, you know, at the time, almost 300 Cisco components in the data center and probably 50 of those in this production zone. And so he goes, okay, listen, he goes, I got to give you my honest opinion. I think we've been hacked by the Chinese.
Yes.
And I mean, I could not write something that good. And I looked at him and I said, really? I said, what? Why do you say that? He goes, listen, he goes, I've been looking at the logs, and he goes, I'm telling you right now, this has got to be something related to the Chinese. And I said, well, I'm not sure that it's something related to the Chinese. And he goes, okay, well, if it's not that, he goes, it's probably that Cisco VLAN 1 exploit. And I was like, well, no, I said, because VLAN 1 is shut down. I said, yeah, VLAN 1 is shut down on all of our components. I'm like, so, and I'm pretty sure you need physical access to the gear in order to try to launch that exploit. And he goes, okay, he goes, I think we've been hacked then. And I said, well, that may be a little early. And so as this conversation is going on, that was the SSO. My director comes up. And unfortunately, this wasn't, as Ethan, as you had described, wasn't a director who was there to sort of facilitate and make the troubleshooting situation any easier. He comes in, and before asking how anything was going, the first thing he says is, he looks at me and he goes, I told you we should have switched out to Juniper. So I look at him, and literally, it was almost as if he and the SSO had like waited in the hallway, coordinated what they were going to say when they came in, and picked the most ridiculous things they could possibly say given the situation. So I looked at him and I said, yeah, I said, I to be honest with you, I don't know if we had Juniper gear, if this would be a different situation. And he goes, okay, he goes, well, you've got about 30 minutes to get this solved before we've got people that are going to be on the phone with a lot of other organizations that are downstream depending on this data. And I said, okay, I said, well, we're doing everything that we can. You know, we had opened up a TAC case and everything. And so we, again, narrowed it down to the 6509. And, you know, Ed and I are sitting there looking at it. And then a very good friend of mine, Andrew Culp, who is now at E+, he came upstairs. And he goes, yeah, he goes, what do you think it is? And I said, you know, we're really not sure. And he was like, okay, he goes, well, you know, maybe, you know, it's got to be something. I got on there. I was able to get a proc CPU, show proc CPU to run. And at that point, you could clearly see that the ARP packet, I mean, it was like almost 9,500%. And I'm like, yeah, it's got to be something to do with spanning tree. So Andrew says, he goes, well, he'll tell you what, he goes, let's do this. He goes, it's got to be something on this switch. He goes, let's drop out the line cards one by one and see if we can't isolate it. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you know, definitely. So, you know, thank goodness Andrew came up. So he pops the first line card out. As soon as he did that, the spanning tree issue stopped. Everything completely stopped. Everything started working again. And so I said, okay, well, it's got to be something plugged into this line card. And that's when we noticed that there were four cables that had been plugged into that line card that weren't labeled and didn't appear to belong in that line card.
Ooh, so then I unlabeled saw four
cables kind of bundled off to the side, and I'm like, okay, well, this can't be right. So we trace the cables out real quickly, and it leads over to a new AIX server. It was a P, I want to say it was a P6 or a P7. And Ed looks at me and he goes, yeah, he goes,
I know where this is going.
Yeah. Ed goes, yeah, Alex was working on those earlier today, wasn't he? And I'm like, well, he shouldn't have been. I said, because there's no change. There were no change control that had been approved for the day. And sure enough, what Alex had done was he had plugged in the both VIO server connections. He was trying to practice with the shared Ethernet adapter failover creation. And there's actually an IBM Red Book out there with a big note right below the section that talks about setting this up that says failover of the shared Ethernet adapters, if not properly configured, can cause broadcast storms. And so he had plugged himself in to these four ports from a previous server he had been working on where BPDU guard hadn't been set up, put him in there, tried to configure the dual VIO, couldn't get it to work, and then came downstairs. So like almost in Pulp Fiction time sequencing, right? You know, he does this, comes downstairs and says, hey, dude, your VPN's broke, right? Not understanding that what he had just done had caused this entire situation. And so very similar to Daniel's story, he not only did he go to lunch, he just decided, I'm going home for the day. So he had left the building completely, had gone home. So we got everything put back together, had gotten everything sorted out. And there was a really big meeting a couple days after that with a lot of people that wore suits and ties. And Alex got to explain to everyone how we ended up where we were at. And then to sort of close on the story, and Ethan, I had put this in the email, I thought this was the most entertaining part, was that a couple months prior to this, I had put in a change control requesting that we go through and for all host-facing ports, we apply BPDU guard to make sure that we didn't run into any issues because the environment was, again, had kind of been kludged together and there was a building move that was involved. And so things were kind of just plugged in real quickly to get things up and running. And the individual who was in charge of the change control port told me that he wasn't sure that the value of applying that command outweighed the risks of applying that command to each of the host interfaces. And I said, I could test it out. I said, I could proof of concept it in the development zone for you. And he said, well, we're going to have to defer this change right now, but we'll come back to it at a later date. And that later date turned out to be the day after this outage.
Yeah.
Everybody
was very familiar.
Yeah.
And this is one of the, I mean, I've raved about this before about, you know, networking being unreliable, because the thing is that could you really sit there in front of the change manager and say implementing BPDU card will absolutely cause you no problems whatsoever? Right?
Right.
You can't, can you? You can't. Right?
Right.
Because so you, As a networking industry as a whole, and this is one of the rants that I get on that I get a lot of abuse for, is we implemented spanning tree, but we never moved past spanning tree to fix the fact that it's unreliable. Neither the industry, nor the customers, not the vendors, not the standards bodies, not all the people who are responsible for fixing spanning tree ever. Still, nobody today wants to fix spanning tree, even though it's caused massive outages like what you've done, like what we've talked about here twice or three times now, spanning tree loops, right, bridging loops. But we all chose Ethernet because it was cheaper. We all chose to keep spanning tree because it was cheaper than fixing it. And so, and even when we put the fixes on spanning tree, they were still not able to make your network reliable. So you couldn't sit there and say, I'll just implement BPDU guard while it's running. It'll be fine. Because it just doesn't work that way. Makes me angry and sad at the same time. If you know what I mean. Am I wrong? Yeah. Am I raving wrongly or what?
Greg, I think you're right on. And all of the latest fixes for these issues and things like that, well, the industry wants to, oh, well, we'll license that to you, you know, and makes it less than ideal to move off of you know, spanning tree or to something better.
So you're referring to the fact that Fabric Path and VCS and, you know, Trill related things are cost money. Cost big money, in fact.
Yeah. You cost big money and are, you know, out of the reach of a lot of us that deal with this issue the most. You know,
how do you justify it to your management?
You know, sometimes I couldn't even justify a pair of redundant switches in a spot. You know, how am I going to justify, you know, something that's licensed to, you know, to the shiny gold coins?
Yeah. Travis, I got a kick out of the part of your story about the unlabeled cables. I worked in an environment once where the data center manager would do a walkthrough of the racks periodically, and if there was any cables not labeled to standard or not labeled at all, he would issue a warning, kind of a shot across the bow, saying, this is going to be either removed or labeled properly, or I'm going to cut it. and he did, on more than one occasion, you'd see a 6 inches of stump hanging out of a switch or the back of a server because it was unlabeled and it didn't follow spec. It was priceless that he would do that. And in some other occasions, he would. I worked an early shift, so I'd be there at my desk at 6 or 6:30 in the morning. He tended to be in very early as well. On more than one occasion, I would find him sitting across the aisle from me, going, "So I found this cable. What do you know about this?" I mean, this guy was just vigilant and adamant about these kind of things. Just priceless stuff. Just really great.
Yeah, I was going to say, to David's point on being able to get the tools. It was, at the time, it was interesting. The previous network admin they were using MRTG, and that was all they had. And I had said, well, maybe we should look at something low cost like a SolarWinds or something like that. And at least we would have, you know, been able to take a look and see, hey, which ports on which switches, did anything change right around that time? Mm-hmm. And the previous admin had told them, oh, no, MRTG will give you that. And I'm like, yeah, no. I said, MRTG is not going to tell us that. So we need to get, you know, SolarWinds or What's Up Gold, or, you know, we need something in here that's going to be a, you know, a tool that we can use to help us. And about a month or two after the large incident, we had a SolarWinds deployment kick off.
Yeah. Many years ago, I was working for a government agency that got hit by a virus. And 2 weeks prior to that, I had been denied for a whole antivirus package for the company or that state agency that I had put through. We should do this, put this on the desktop, put this on the servers, and this will prevent these sorts of problems. We've never had a problem like that. It's never going to be an issue. And then this virus went, it was the I love you virus that hooked into your email and address book and mailed itself to everybody. And it just raped the whole network. It was brutal. People's machines would crank up, the CPUs would spike, and I love you just spewed out into everybody's email. Email boxes just clogged with constant messages flooding in. And all of a sudden, the funding was available for that. Once we got that behind us, it was a mess until that point. But yeah, it's amazing where money materializes from when you've got a specific problem to solve.
Yeah, funny, you know, when it's clearly identified and the use case is obviously, you know, big difference about the use case after it's been proven. Yeah.
So you want to start a broadcast storm so you can justify getting the better tools and.
That is the grumpy old engineer view right there. I love it.
I'm going to plug this. The old joke of the network terminator that's on one end is like a 110-volt plug and the other end is a RJ45. It's like, I'll fix this right now and get some new gear.
There'll be a short outage while we see how good our vendors respond. See if they can meet their contractual obligations. What about load balances? Has anybody had any load balancer problems? Have anybody got any load balancer war stories?
There's one. When I worked for Sprint as somewhat of a systems engineer, and we did a lot of networking as well, we had a customer call in, and they were, you know, and they had this load balanced web servers. I don't know if they were Apache or if it was Sun 1, but it was, you know, these were sitting behind F5 load balancers. In one of our data centers, we had 7 or 8 of them. And so what we the customer's complaint was that one specific server was just hitting 100% load and was just getting overloaded. And they're like, "You guys are load balancing. Why does this all? Why is this happening all the time?" And I mean, it's a simple fact that load balancers are kind of dumb. That you can either do it based on an IP hash or maybe some source port stuff. But these things have like Java application engines behind them and these massive Oracle databases behind that. So it's really kind of hard to balance those out if it's not strictly from IP to IP. And it probably took us a couple of weeks to troubleshoot. But what was happening is like every day at the same time, I don't remember what the nature of their business was, but they one server would get overloaded, and you could never tell which one it would be, but it would happen at the same time. And over about a 2-week period, we finally got enough trending to see that it was coming from one specific IP address. That every day at X time, this one IP address would hammer and get and just beat the crap out of one of the servers, and it was never load balancing. And the problem was, is if you had a small office of like 35 people that were behind a single NAT point, the F5 was set to do IP hash, source dest hash, as its load balancing algorithm. So 35 people at once were doing all of this business, and since it all came from one IP address, it was destroying one server because the load balancer was doing exactly what its dumb self was told to do.
F5 has been it's like, I love the platform, I just adore it. I'm really a big F5 fan, and but at the same time, when everything in your data center, this one particular data center I worked at, was going through the F5s, anytime you did an upgrade, it was kind of like, I'm scared, but I'm going to do it. And you do it because you had some reason that we'd always had some specific feature driver that we were trying to keep up with what was going on our F5s. Well, one particular post-upgrade scenario was very slow performance of an SSL gateway, this one SSL gateway that a lot of our customers were processing against. And long story short, upgrade the F5. This was back in the 9.2, 9.3, 9.4 days. I don't remember exactly what the code family was, but F5 had changed the default TCP profile to include Nagel's algorithm. And Nagel's algorithm was now enabled by default when previously it had not been enabled. And so the end impact was slow and unpredictable performance for SSL terminations, things that were flowing, not terminated on the F5, but terminated through the F5. We had some folks that didn't want to do SSL offload. They wanted to just pass the SSL through. And Nagel's algorithm on this TCP profile was screwing things up. And you say, yes, but surely you didn't use the default TCP profile on those virtual servers, because who would do that? Well, no, we didn't. But the TCP profiles that we did use inherited the default TCP profile for a lot of stuff. So unfortunately, we still got dinged with it in that case. But that was one of those head-scratchers for days and days, and F5 support can't figure it out, and we don't know what's going on, and customers are impacted, but it's not a consistent problem, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it's slow. And finally, we got a hold of our regional SE, who was just a wizard at F5. So he was magic, had been there with the company for a very long time and had a huge lab of his own that he would work with customers to set up scenarios and stuff. And he knew right away, as soon as we described the problem to him, oh, it's Nagel's algorithm. Go in here, go into TCP profile, disable it, and boom. And boom, sure enough, that fixed the problem, which was a relief. One of those nagging, hair-pulling problems where you go to bed that night having not solved it, and you can hardly sleep because it's all you can think about. What the heck is the problem? And finally getting through it was tremendous. Now, John, I think we haven't heard your story, right?
Oh, yes. And I'm strictly in the layer one guy here. We had a great problem. And, like everyone else was able to point the finger at someone else, and this finger went right at me. We had a data center move about 4 years ago. And we were moving from our facility, which was a somewhat smaller, to a facility that was about three times as large. But this facility was the computer center for our campus at one time. And it's about 45 years old. Asbestos in the ceiling, so you can't go in the ceiling. cabling under the floor was a god-awful mess. I don't know how there was any airflow through the floor because there was so much cable there.
Awesome.
And I mean, there's Cat 5, fiber, thin net, thick net, video cable, you name it, it was under the floor.
Twin X. I remember Twin X.
Those little emulator boards.
The previous tenant organization had moved out and moved into a brand new computer center. And so I put the question to him, well, we need some help to identify what cabling is live that we have to watch out for. And never got an answer on that because they were so enamored about their new move and their new computer center, and they were working wildly to get that done. So we had to put in some new electrical in the area, and so we had to clean out some of this cabling because the electricians couldn't do their work, and they were putting in a new VESDA system for fire protection, smoke detection. And so we had to clean it out somehow because we had to get this, the other contractors, at least allow them to get their work done. So we began a cleanup process and started pulling cable. And one day, you know, we had already moved a massive amount of cable, removed a massive amount of cable. And one day, came over to the computer center. I had a student and myself were pulling some old thick net cable, and we had pulled about 25 meters of this stuff, you know, about five cables, and pulled it all the way to what was a channel to a room that across the hall. So I said to my student, well, go ahead and cut the cables because we're not going to pull them through. And he said, okay, and started cutting the cables. Well, one of them didn't have an end on it. He couldn't trace the end. And I said, he said to me, oh, should I cut this one too? And I said, go ahead, cut it. You know, you're so damn tired of all the cable. Well, the other ones were thick net. This was turned out not to be thick net. No, this was a yellow fiber, single mode fiber cable bunch.
Which looks just like thick net. I mean, such an easy mistake to make.
Well, guess what? This one, you know, usually the single mode cable has a Kevlar jacket to it. This did not. Obviously, we wouldn't have been able to cut through it. So there was nothing was obvious. And so, you know, we finished up, pulled the cable, threw it in the trash, closed up. I drive back to my office, and I'm IMing with a colleague on our local IM server who works for the core networking group for our campus. He says, well, the network went down. Our internet service provider connection's down. We're trying to figure out what's going on. I'm like, well, I was just at the computer center and we just cut some cables. And he said, as you can imagine, they had a team dispatched immediately. I showed them where the cut was, and yes, it was the our one and only internet connection on the campus, which, by the way, had this occurred a week later, would not have, you know, we would have had a short outage because they were already moving toward that second external connection.
And there's no way you could blame this on a backhoe or anything?
I went ahead and I had to take that bullet.
Brutal.
But
John, I think you had sent the picture along of that, all the cable under the floor, right? Wasn't that you?
I sent the picture. Yeah, that was just an example of what we were dealing with.
Can we share that picture?
Oh, sure.
Because we should embed that in the blog post. It's a horror show. It's exactly what you were describing. I worked at a data center that was similar to that once, where we were actually migrated away from it. And you throw the tile puller down, you pop the tile, and you look down, and all you see is this ocean rat's nest twist and turn of cables. And it's the same problem we had there that you were describing, where you're pulling on cables and trying to trace from one end of this data center to the other, and you got your hand buried inside of cables, tugging with the one hand and feeling with the other for the tug, so you know what cable it is you're tracing out, and somehow you still manage to screw it up. You can't help it. It's just such a disaster.
Part of it is you get so disgusted, and it's like, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, cut it. Just do it. Cut it. What could go wrong?
Sort of like the guy who was cutting the cables on the switches, like you were saying before.
Actually, you reminded me. We finally moved out of that data center. We moved into the new one. We had to decom the old one, and we were cutting out cable for the scrap guy to come, because there was however much you would get a pound for the cable. And we were happily cutting cables. There certainly was no data going through it. We knew that. We knew what could go wrong, right? Cutting cables, and then pow, we hear this huge pop come from from one of the racks, and I turned around and look, and there's one of the guys I work with is standing there with these cutters in his hand. There's this big scorch mark on the rack right next to him, and he's like, oh, that electric cable, that was live. Yeah, wow.
Similar incident like that happened in that room too, when they were taking down a tape library. Guy cut the power cable, didn't know it was live. So that place was a disaster.
Yeah.
That whole move was a disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had several years ago, we had we were moving our DMARC from one building to another, and the LEC had approved, said, yep, everything's swung, everything's moved, and they were going to tear down the building next to where the DMARC used to be. And so there was some cable that went between the two buildings, and the maintenance guys get out there and they check. They say, we better pull this in case they grab it with the backhoe. We don't pull it through the building and rip things out. Sure, this is okay? Everybody goes, yeah, it's okay. Go ahead and do it. So guy gets in the hole and hacksaws the cable. That was still our entrance cable.
Oops.
T1s drop, PRIs drop, everything goes down. Like, that's a problem.
There's so many quotables from this show. It's just great.
Well, it's like all the cable cutting is like my favorite networking joke. Is if you're ever going to go hiking, always take about a 3.5 to 4 foot piece of fiber with you. Because if you get lost, you can bury it in the ground at least 6 inches, and within 15 minutes, a backhoe will show up to cut it, and then you can get a ride back to town.
Well, I was buying drinks and pizza for the guy, the Verizon techs who were refusing the fiber.
Yeah.
I was going to say it's interesting you talk about the electrical. At the same facility where I had the experience with the spanning tree, we had a very junior engineer who, and this wasn't in the production area, but had taken went under the floor, you know, through the tile puller down, and we were explicitly told, you're not supposed to be under the floor, you're not supposed to be plugging in circuits on your own. So he decided he couldn't wait for power, took an L520 receptacle and jammed it into an L630 whip and cranked it in there so hard that they couldn't get it out. And here's how we found out that he'd done it. He came to me and he said, hey, I need you to come take a look at this switch. I can't get, for whatever reason, I can't get onto the switch. And so that L520 connector went into a sort of a PDU type unit. So I come up, I plug my laptop into that same PDU unit, and I go to connect in the console cable, and there's this huge flash and a bang on the back of the Switch where the console cable was going to go in, and I almost fell down. And I'm like, oh. I was like, what, Kenny, what happened here? And he goes, Travis, I don't know what to tell you. And I said, well, you know, this isn't normal. I said, where did you plug all this stuff in? And he goes, well, it's down here under the floor. And I said, well, you're not supposed to be under the floor. You know that, right? So we had the electrical guy come up, and I said, yeah. I said, something's not right with this. And he pulls the floor tile up, and he looks at us, and he goes, which one of you morons did this? And so it took him about 30 minutes to unseat that L520 connector out of the L630 whip.
That's wild.
Yeah, the way he explained it.
If you're forcing it, there's probably something wrong. You don't.
Yeah.
Typically, networking does not involve a lot of blunt force trauma unless you're head desking. That's really about it.
Isn't there like a phrase, like, if it doesn't fit, force it. If it breaks, it needed replacing anyway, or something like that?
Exactly. Exactly. I'm not sure if I should have saved that story for the near-death episode of the
I mean, it's near death. I mean, I took a network down a long time ago, and it was purely just something I didn't foresee happening. And I was still a bit green. But in the job I had, I was going up to drop in a router at a newspaper, and it was going to facilitate some dial-up networking. And since, you know, the newspaper had a very mixed environment, so they've got Macs in there, and they've got network servers, and they've got standard IP stuff, so we've got to run the entire suite over dial-up RAS. And so we start getting this thing hooked up. We decide where it's going to be plugged in. We plug in, you know, the LAN side of the thing, and the only thing I've gotten plugged in so far is IP, and we get this test, and we're like, okay, we're fine. Let's go ahead and start cranking up IPX. And I was, you know, a pretty well knowledgeable network engineer at the time. And so I went and asked him, it's like, we need to go look at the network server and figure out what the IPX network seed is so that we don't, you know, override that and then we don't replace it. This all need to be, you know, this needs to match. And while we're at it, we need to go look at the AppleTalk network and figure out what the AppleTalk zone seed number is so we can be in the same one so we're not creating a new zone and people, you know, this all just works. It was like two of the most, you know, the worst protocols to ever have to try to, you know, you can't route them, but you can bridge the crap out of them. And, you know, I've always hated AppleTalk because AppleTalk to me is kind of like, you know, that if you live in an apartment complex, you've got a drunk neighbor, and every time he comes home, he's like, he knocks on your door. He's like, hey, do I live here? No, try the next door, you know. And I've always hated AppleTalk. So, but, you know, and what happens here wasn't malicious. It was just pure accident, but it was one of the most mortifying situations where I'm sitting there and I've done this and have to kind of go, well, I guess we're going to have to fix this. So,
has anybody here done much with IDSs? Like where somebody puts an IDS and it's in line and it's in protect mode? And
yeah, every day.
Yeah.
We've broke a lot of things that way, especially when we had to test them at ISS. When there's like, you know, we got the decree. It's like, we're going to eat our own dog food. You got to put this thing in line in protection mode between these core switches and somewhere else. I'm like, all right, but I want to sign a piece of paper from somewhere, from somebody saying it's not my fault when this shit breaks everything.
Yeah.
But so I flip this router on and I enable IPX. And the first thing that happens is someone just kind of goes screams like, hey, I can't get to the network anymore. And we go look, and me turning on IPX caused the network cluster to abend itself. So it's sitting there with a nice, you know, green, yellow screen, whatever. So these things are dead.
There's a whole crew of young engineers that have no idea what you just said. NLM and abend?
Abend is an abnormal ending, or basically the equivalent of a blue screen of death on a network server. This is like network, I don't know, it's probably 312, 412, something like that, you know, long, long ago. At York. And at the same time, I also enabled AppleTalk. And, you know, I had made all the precautions. Like, I knew all the numbers. I knew all the other things. Like, here's the seed things. Here's where we want to be. This is should be fine. Enable AppleTalk, and the entire Macintosh network implodes on itself. Everything goes offline. Nobody can talk to anything, and chaos ensues. At the moment when that router came online and joined the AppleTalk network as a seed and as somewhat of a router to say, hey, I'm here. Every AppleTalk device lost its mind and then decided to start seeding its own you know, random things because they lost how to talk to it. So now every HP or Apple printer in the place that's got a JetDirect card or is actually a LaserJet 2 or a, you know, an Apple LaserJet is now seeding its own AppleTalk zone names and its own seed numbers. Random PCs are joining random zones. I mean, it's the worst possible scenario because you can't fix any of that.
No, so, boy, my AppleTalk days, I did have, sorry to interrupt you, this is just as quick. The thing that I remember having to do dealing with a lot of Macs was who left the chooser open, because if someone left the chooser open, that would broadcast and chatter and slow everybody else down as we're running around from Mac to Mac trying to figure out who left the chooser open. Anyway, I never ran into a horror show quite like you're describing.
Well, right, so my only solution at the time is like we tried, because every time a new device would come online, it would pick a random zone and a random seed that was just now created and join it. So like there'd be groups of three or four machines talking to each other, but they couldn't talk to the thing across the cube row. Just it's utter chaos. So I was like, well, I hate to say this, but we're gonna have to turn all of this shit off. All of it. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, shut it all down. Because it's never gonna work. And we had to go around hunting printers, because some of them were hidden in little closets and rooms and things, and they're just out there happily broadcasting out new zones, and we'd think we had them all down, and we're still seeing these things pop up and people joining the wrong networks. It took an entire afternoon to recover from that. It was down 4 or 5 hours. I mean, this happened like right before lunch. It was, I think we finally got it all fixed by about 4:30 or 5, but we'd pretty much ruined the production day. And I was like, well, I hope that never happens to me ever again.
It's funny when you were talking about NetWare 3.x and 4.x. I mean, those were the days. I made a lot of money fixing Novell stuff and making Novell servers work, and it's taking me back. I remember sitting at
bridging it over ISDN between like office locations.
I never had to do anything crazy like that, because back in the days that I was doing Novell, I wasn't really all that much of a network guy. Then again, networking by itself wasn't a big thing. It was just like kind of part of what you did. You know, you had to pick your Ethernet frame type when you're setting up the Novell server for whatever kind of a network it was on. And you didn't really think about it all that much. And it was fairly rare that you'd run into, you know, the kind of networking that all of us do now, you know, where that's our whole life is really networking and transport and connecting from point A to point B. But boy, NetWare and all the time you'd spend dealing with, okay, I needed to update the backup exec NLMs, and then you get a call the next day, you know, the backup failed, and by the way, the server isn't responding anymore, and you show up and the thing's dead, it's abandoned, sitting there because an upgrade put the whole server at risk. I mean, those really were the days. And I think part of what really drove so many people to towards NT, because NT was the answer. By gosh, it was so solid and it was so stable and all the things that NetWare struggled with and wasn't for a long time. Even though NetWare had the better, with NDS, they really had the better strategy on things. Microsoft just clobbered them in the marketing department and reputation department and went to town with AD. And never look back. And poor Novell, they're still around, I believe, right?
I'm not sure how, but I guess, you know, I know when I got out of the network business, Network 5 or 5.1 had just come out and actually had an IP stack by default. It wasn't something that you had to go, back.
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't.
And it was actually
right.
Running X Windows on top of the network server, so you had like a real full GUI, not just a, you know, the old hacker terminal where you're like, well, that's a couple things I can do here, but you really have to have a client to go deal with it. And I never really did anything past network 5 because at that point I had really got into WAN and building dial-up ISPs and a lot of other, you know, IP networking. I was like, oh, this network stuff is probably going to die one of these days, and I haven't really touched it since. That was probably close to 20 years ago.
Well, who's got another story that they wanted to share with us, whether you've gone already or not?
Yeah, I've got a great EMC brocade fiber channel story.
Ooh, okay.
So, and I can mention this company name because it's no longer in business. This was quite some time ago, but I used to work down in Annapolis at US Internetworking, and this was back in the .com days. And this was when brocade was, you know, really kind of just breaking onto the scene and really catching traction with the 2800 series. And we had put in probably close to 60 Brocade 2800 series, and the gentleman that was the lead sort of storage guru for the team decided to take myself and another engineer into the data center to explain to us, you know, how to run cable and how things are supposed to be done, and he wanted things done a certain way. And so we were in there, and there were a couple cables that for whatever reason he was unhappy with how they looked. And so he starts dropping the cables out, and I'm like, can you do that? I mean, is that, that's not going to cause an outage or anything? He's like, no, this is, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. And so he starts rerouting all of these fiber channel cables, and probably within a minute, someone comes running into the data center, and they're like, hey, Marty, we need you in the NOC right now. We got two outages, and it looks like their servers are down. Like, they can't see the storage for some reason. So Marty looks at him, and he goes, yeah, he goes, I'll be right in there. And he looks at me, and he goes, yeah, you know, you got to fix problems sooner or later. I was amazed. So, but yeah, then he ran in there and fixed the problem, and we watched as he took full credit for not only identifying the issue but resolving the issue. And yeah, it was pretty crazy, pretty crazy.
Wow.
That's got kahunas.
Yeah, I was going to say, that takes a pair to cause the problem, then go in and identify the problem and take credit for fixing the problem.
It was like nothing I had ever seen before. And it was interesting because as we left out of the NOC after he had resolved, you know, they had to reboot the servers and bring those LUNs back online. And he looks at me and he goes, just remember, Travis, admit to nothing, deny everything, and make counter accusations. I couldn't believe it. I said, Marty, I don't know if you're going to be around long, if that's how you're going to approach things. So, but yeah, that was the first time I had ever seen anybody do something like that. Literally just take servers down and then act as if nothing had happened and that they were there and that they could resolve the issue, and they did.
Wow.
I'm jealous.
That's like some true BOFH level of awesomeness right there.
Oh, yeah. That is great.
I wonder how many people he had kicked down the elevator shaft and covered them in Clicklime.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing was, is like I said, this is the Brocades were new. We had just rolled a bunch of stuff out. And as we were in there, he was explaining, oh, you know, these Brocades, I'm not sure how reliable they are. And it's probably got something to do with that. And, you know, we'll take a look at it tomorrow to see maybe if we can get some, you know, logs or something. And, you know, because nobody knew any better. There was no visibility into sort of the storage area network and how he was rolling things out. So, but it was definitely entertaining to watch him work.
There was somebody hit on earlier talking about somebody just like went home for the day. I don't know if that was David or someone, whoever it was talking about that, where the guy broke the VPN. But one of my coworkers these years ago, he kind of nonchalantly walks over to us one day, and he was like trying to upgrade a Cisco router in Belgium. And I don't know what had happened, but you know, either halfway between him getting the, you know, he would routinely never write a config. So if we ever had a power outage, it's like the perimeter router suddenly didn't know their AS numbers anymore and what their, you know, BGP peers were supposed to be. And I mean, multiple times we go to reboot and, you know, code something, or someone would, you know, accidentally hit a power cable doing something else, reboot this router, and it comes up with no config because nobody ever, you know, wrote the config last time they fixed it. And this guy was notorious for this. So he walks over one day, it's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he's like, hey guys, if Belgium calls, tell them I went home. I'm like, why? What were you doing something? He's like, no, it's just, you know, their router's down. So just let you know. And walked out the door. And so we figured out later that he was apparently trying to upgrade the iOS, but either the flash on the router didn't have enough storage space for two concurrent iOS images, or he just did something stupid by deleting the one that was there and then tried to upload the new one. And somewhere in the upload of the new iOS bin file, the router rebooted, either due to a bug or some sort of a power issue or something else dumb happened, and that router was sitting there with no iOS to boot.
He
drops the mic, walks out.
Drops the mic, walks out.
I like the 8 mile.
My
router.
Work here is done.
You know that one where you do debug IP and let it go because you want to see all the IP packets coming through the router and you're young.
I've done
and,
that if, you know, or debug all.
Yeah. I took about, I don't know, 3,000 to 4,000 people off from the rest of the network and isolated them because the one router that was the backhaul to the main network. Yeah, I did that on that one. I don't remember what possessed me to do that, but I had that same kind
have
of a
ever,
speech
have
where.
Done a debug? Debug IP all with a syslog enabled.
Yeah.
And the root is, and you're thinking to yourself, this root is, no, it's only running at, you know, I look at the, you check the chat, you know, it's only running at 10 megs. Yeah. It's fine, right? And you do a debug IP all, but what you've forgotten is you're on a 1 meg frame relay.
That's right.
And you've taken out the frame relay because it's full of syslog data.
I had done that debug command. Everything went dark. The router console was no longer responding to my Telnet or SSH, whatever it was, and I had that moment of, I know what I just did. Yeah. Walked into my manager's office. I got to go over to South Campus. Why? The router's down. I got to go reboot it. I fessed up later to what I'd done, but it was one of those moments. I got to go now. I can fix this, but I got to get in the car. I'll see you later. We'll talk about what happened.
Once upon a time, I got into a phase of configuring Cisco routers with IP local policies so that the Telnet and the, like, if you want to secure the SSH and the syslog, you can create a local policy, which basically uses policy-based routing for everything. And this was going to be, like, the way for me to secure all console access. Except when you create a local policy, everything breaks. SNMP, Telnet, SSH, all follows. Any traffic generated by the router,
OSPF,
PGP, all follows the local policy. You go, blah, 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 IP local. Oh, this is a great command, IP local. Look at that, it'd secure everything. If there wasn't a matching entry, it would automatically be, you know, a completely different path. That, you know, shut down the whole box. All the routing dropped, all the finger pay. Oh, it was dreadful. Yeah.
Mistake you only make once.
I had when I started, I was doing a lot of PC support, and we used Ghost, and we'd ghost Ghost systems, you know, and this was back in Windows 98 era, you know, and we'd do them from this one server. We'd load the image on, run the ghost. Everything was fine and dandy. I said, I loaded up a new image, and I said, well, I'm going to run the ghost executable, this whole process, from my laptop here. So I did that. You know, all of a sudden, I got 15 people at my door. We just dropped off the network. And I'm going, huh, I wonder what happened. Then I looked. I was on a hub, a dual speed hub, and all these other clients were 10 half. And I just loaded the whole thing with multicast.
Okay.
at 100 meg. And every single one of those clients that was 10 half goes, I don't know what to do. rule of thumb, never do that again.
Yeah, exactly.
Things you only do once. What about Nexus 5000s and VPCs and keeping VPC configurations in sync? I've had a lot of pain with that. Where the two, you know, the port profiles on one have to be identical to the one on the right before the VPCs will sync up. Anybody else?
Oh, gosh. Actually, I have had that problem because you started that and I was thinking, no, actually, I've had pretty good luck. And then you explained, and I'm like, oh, no, yeah, I have had that problem. Yep, sure have.
Yeah. Because where it caught me out was I had some firewalls connected to Nexus 5000s. And, of course, the one side was fine. But when we failed over, it wouldn't work. And when we failed back, it would work. And you're going, is it the HA? Is it the firewall HA? Or is it the switch? No, all the VLANs are propagated out the port, and eventually we worked out it was the VPC sync wasn't working. So when the failover happened, the flows weren't being diverted over. But being what it was, we spent a lot of time looking at the HA configuration of the firewall and figured that, you know, the HA wasn't failing over. But what would happen is it would just go out. And it took us quite a while. We lost about an hour and a half of troubleshooting. It was only in a lab, so the world wasn't ending. But it was the VPC configuration which was the problem. And comes back to this HA thing. Every time you do a HA feature like multi-chassis Ether channel or VSS or IRF or whatever vendor you're using, setting up those HA features requires, you know, attention to detail to get them working right.
So here's what's funny. I actually am in my Evernote. I had written an internal article for exactly this problem, and it's fairly long, showing output about why your VPC ports might not come up and all the things that you need to check and so on. Yes, I had this problem.
Should the theme of this session be looking in all the wrong places?
It sure could be. I love the security stories. The number of times I've worked with companies and the security officer is always convinced that we've been hacked, or we're being hacked, or there's a DDoS attack. And it's never, ever, ever turned out to be we're hacked or being DDoSed.
No, I've only ever worked in one place where they'd even be a likely target. It's like, why would you think we're being hit by the Chinese? Why would they care about us over here? Are you kidding?
I made a note when they were saying earlier about, you know, the guy comes in and asks, you know, these coordinated questions about, you know, it's, we should have went to Juniper, or it's the Chinese hacking us. And I've long suspected that there's some sort of a secret publication that's only delivered to like C-level executives that just has a lot of stupid buzzwords and questions that they should be asking people. And it's, you know, because, or like, you know, just these technology, something's like, ask your IT staff about this. It's like, dude, why, because there can't be any other rational explanation other than there's a trade paperback that just has a list of dumb shit in it. That's the only thing I could possibly come up with, and it's partly conspiracy theorists, but that's all I've been able to figure out of all the years I've done this. I've always been asked dumb questions.
Over your shoulder, they'll help you fix the problem.
Oh, right. Yeah. And it's like movie buzzwords coming out. I was like, well, we need to, you know, create a new IP interface using Visual Basic, and then we'll be able to route through the, you know, whatever. It's like, go away. I'm trying to troubleshoot.
So I have a side job writing white papers and reports for various press, you know, media companies around the world. It's probably me.
Greg Fairless, the ceiling execs on the planet with bad
you
emotion.
Prick. Oh, Pharaoh, I knew it.
If you figure that they send over things like, give me the I need an article, it's got to be 2,000 words and it has to be the top 10 things about SDN. Well, what do you write? You know. So you pick 10 things that are, you know, and that's what the guy reads. And then he thinks, oh, I've got the top 10 things. I must know everything they need to know about SDN. It's not my fault that they read an article which was like 2,000 words to explain SDN is way hard, right? Because there's an awful lot of stuff going on. You know, that's not just like a bike wheel where you look down at the pedals and you see the pedal linked to the gear linked to the back wheel. SDN is a V8 motor with gears and pistons, and there's a 5-speed gearbox and a differential at the back with a floating diff. You know, it's not quite so obvious what's happening inside. It looks just like a bike, but it ain't, you know.
I've got a very amusing story from way back when. I used to work in academia many years ago, and this was after I left, but my previous department had bought a big Sun box, and it decided that, you know, everybody had little Sun workstations. They were going to concentrate everything on this big Sun box, and I had this one big Sun box. That was fine. That was happy. And another department decided that they would do a security test, and so they picked this big Sun box. And they thought, well, we better tell somebody. We'll tell the central IT people. They didn't actually tell the owners of the box, and so, you know, the owner of the box was, you know, going, oh my god, we're getting hacked, and it looks like it's internal, and no, this is horrible, we're getting hacked. Final solution, I'll reboot the box. So reboots the box, and of course this is run by mathematicians and statisticians, or mathematicians who write really long jobs that don't have any checking in them. So, you know, if you kill it, that's like a month and a half's worth of CPU just gone. And one of these people happened to be the head of the department. And yes, I heard that there was a bit of an inquisition against between various departments and the central IT people there, and much shouting and blood was let as somebody's 3 months worth of you know, 3 actual months of computation was disappeared in a reboot. Yeah, picking the most important box of another department to try and do your intrusion test on, and then not telling them, was probably a very unwise thing to do.
Yes,
especially.
I was talking to a guy the other day. One of the place where I currently work is a government lab with high performance computing, and this guy came along. He said, "I've got this script." He said, "I've been, you know." He's got a graphical rendition of a protein molecule, and what he's doing is regressing the protein molecule back over 10,000 or 20,000 years to show that, you know, 20,000 years ago the protein molecule would look like this, and this is what it looks like today, and therefore, and this is science, right?
Yep.
And he'd been developing this script on his computer, and he'd spent 3 years of a PhD building the model, but he said having problems getting the whole – he wanted to make a video as part of his final thesis. And he took it to the supercomputing people, and they brought it in. And so they took his script and they loaded it up on the supercomputer, and they said it's probably going to take about a week. We think it'll be, so they just, you know, so they just set the script off, you know, put some resources to the job, and away it went. It finished in about 20 minutes. And they said, oh, that's not, you know, we'll do it again. So they ran it again, and it took 20 minutes. And it said, it turns out the guy had been running it at home, and he'd written the script in such a way that it was memory hungry. So it just. So, of course, what it did was it just swapped out to hard drive all the time. And when they put it into the high-performance computing and gave it like 16 gigabytes of RAM per thread, it just took off and sorted itself out about 20 minutes.
Awesome. Look at that. That's delicious memory.
Yeah, that's right. He said that there was no swapping in their environment because they were doing 16 gigs of thread. And here, this guy had like, you know, a 4-gig machine. He was going like, oh, it's so precious. Taking me weeks to get the first 10 seconds. It was like, pretty funny. So. We should probably try and make this quarterly, Ethan, I think.
I think we've latched on to something here. These stories are great. and as we keep talking, I keep thinking of more things.
You, make some of us, you know, go, well, I've done that. Well, everybody's done that.
That's,
you know,
right.
And some people go, well, I can't make a mistake. I'll, you know, well, you know, sometimes the only way you learn is you have to make a mistake.
You you can and you will, and let's remember plausible deniability. That's all. So.
and we've even given you answers, because that guy who actually made the mistake and then went into the data center.
That's right.
Yeah, admit to nothing, deny everything, and make counter accusations.
Yeah, that's right.
It must be the brocades.
Admit to nothing, deny everything, and make counter accusations. Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
That's a very, very Soviet attitude.
Well, you just, all right. Just insert vendor with a name that your CISO or CSO or whoever, you know, C-level says, I do not like that vendor. I'd like them out of our company. Just lay that one out. There we go.
Well, Mr. Fur, what do you say? A lot of war stories and probably a pretty good place for us to wrap up, eh?
Yeah, I think we should get the can of put a lid on it and put it in the corner. And maybe we should take the can out every quarter or so and rerun this, because it's been hugely good fun.
That's right. I absolutely enjoyed this. So yeah. I want to thank Mr. John. You said Mongol Horde, and I'm still not sure how to pronounce your last name, John.
Tatar.
John Tatar, Daniel Powell, Travis Bonfili, Ross Alexander, and David Willanda for joining us. And all you guys, if you would please send me your Twitter handle and blog post or blog URL, and I will include those in the show notes for any of the good people listening that that want to join us or want to follow you. Wow, what a terrible outro. Okay. And Greg, of course, is at Ethereal Mind on Twitter, and you can read his material at etherealmind.com, network computing, and other fine publications online. I I am at EC Banks on Twitter. You can follow my blog, ethancbanks.com, where I write, and just about anything else that I publish, you can find through there. Of course, this is the Packet Pushers podcast. You can find us at Packet Pushers on Twitter and via packetpushers.net. Around the world, all of you that are listening, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and we hope you enjoyed this show, and it was kind of a fun show for your holiday week. If you have any questions about this show, anything we said, or you have some of your own war stories that you'd like to tell on a future podcast, please email us, packetpushers@gmail.com. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.